The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Good afternoon, my conscious co-creators. Welcome to another edition of the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. I am very, very pleased that you are here with me today. Oh, we've got a real special show in store for you today. I'm very excited and thrilled. We've got a wonderful guest in studio with us today. Before I get started with the quotes of the day, I just want to give a quick shout out to everybody who came out to last week's Conscious Business Collective. It was a wonderful meeting, a very interesting balancing of energies, and a great way to spend the evening. We'll be following up, of course, with another meeting this month on the fourth Thursday of the month. I don't know what date that is right at the moment, but you guys know it's like 4 weeks from today. So thanks for being with me. Let's get started with our quotes from the universe and from Abraham. Let's see what the universe and Abraham have in store for us today. First, from Mike Dooley in the universe. It's exactly at times like these, when the going gets tough, rumors are rampant, and people begin to resist change, that you know things are about to get really, really good. You always pick the right time, the right place, and the best genes. All eyes are upon you, the universe. We love our quotes from Mike Dooley in the universe, letting us know, like, hey, don't forget, like, just when times are tough, that means, like, things are just about to shift or change. I had a teacher once who used to say that frustration is an indication of massive change around the corner. And there's a lot of change brewing in a lot of different ways. And I think this is a wonderful and very apropos quote for what we're going to talk about today. So take heart. Don't worry when things are tough. They're not going to stay that way. If one thing you can always count on, things will always change. So not to worry. The universe and all those millions of angels are out there with their eyes upon you. Everything is good. Let's see what the quote we have from Abraham. Actually, our quote today from Abraham is an excerpt from his book, The Vortex. Let's see what it says. The essence of my every desire can be fulfilled. If your space-time reality has the wherewithal to inspire a desire within you, it is our absolute promise to you that your space-time reality has the ability to deliver in full manifested form the reality of the desire it has inspired. Any and all desires can be fulfilled unless you are holding yourself out of alignment with your own desire. The feeling of competition or shortage or limitation of resources means you're out of alignment with your own desire. And that's from Abraham and Esther from the book The Vortex. And so this is a kind of one of these promises that Abraham makes over and over and over again. And that is that if you have a desire, if because of the life you're living, whatever the contrast is, whatever is going on, it brings a desire that bubbles up within you. The fact that you have that desire means the universe has the ability to deliver that desire to you. And again, it may not do it instantaneously right away, but if you have that desire, it can be delivered to you. And if it is not being delivered to you, the only reason why is because of our own resistance to that very same desire. Now, you may be saying to me, Sam, what are you talking about? It's my desire. I want it. I really want it. How come it's not coming? Well, yes, we have desires and we may want things really badly, but if we feel like we don't deserve to have that great relationship or abundance flowing to us or to be recognized for our gifts, if inside of us there's some internal resistance, maybe we're afraid to be in the spotlight, maybe we're just afraid of having things work out so well for us that we're afraid we'll lose it, that creates resistance. That energy creates a resisting energy that causes that the manifesting of that desire to really slow down and either take its time getting to you or not get to you at all. It's really our work always is to line up with the desire, is to line up with that very thing that in our gut we know we want and we can have it. Abraham says, right, that the universe says, if you have this desire, then you can absolutely have its manifestation, its fulfillment. It's just about releasing the resistance. And if you're not sure what that resistance is, sit down, meditate on it, and work on it. Oh, thank you on the Facebook live stream for our listeners. Erica, Lay, Itzhak, thank you for the hearts and the thumbs up. Really appreciate that. So, remember, the essence of every desire can be fulfilled. It's up to us to get into alignment. And the universe has our back. Never worry about that. So, two wonderful quotes. And as you will see, we will work these quotes into our show today. As I would like to welcome to our show today my guest, Dr. Rachel Harris, PhD. She's a psychologist and author of the book, Listening to Ayahuasca, New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. And let me hold it up to the Facebook live stream real quick. This is the book. It's a wonderful book. Get it. She was in private practice for 35 years, maybe more by now, working with people interested in psycho-spiritual development. During a decade of working in research, she received a National Institute of Health's New Investigators Award and published more than 40 scientific studies in peer-reviewed journals. She is also consulted Fortune 500 companies as well as the United Nations. This woman is no slouch. Now, as a result of her own experience with ayahuasca, Dr. Rachel Harris was inspired to research how this medicine was being used in North America in the largest study of its kind to date. Listening to Ayahuasca describes her findings, including miracle cures of depression and addiction, therapeutic breakthroughs, spiritual revelations, and changing and challenging, and even the what we'd call the bad trips. So, Dr. Harris, welcome to the Conscious Consultant Hour.
Thank you so much, Sam.
I'm really happy that we were able to arrange this to get you in studio while you're passing yes. through New York City.
Yes, correct.
It's always great to have you. Now, I know your daughter's in the city. Are you originally from this area? Or?
No. Princeton.
From Princeton. Oh, yeah. Not that far away.
No,
we'll give
far.
It to you. So I always like to start off giving my audience, talking about just a little bit of your background. So you've been a therapist for many, many years. And as our audience know, therapists are very close to our heart because my wife is a psychotherapist.
Right.
And we do EMDR and other forms of CBT and other forms of therapy here in the center. But your work seems to have always had a very spiritual lean to it, no?
Yes, that's correct.
Is there something that kind of...
How did that happen?
Yeah, like what put you on that initial path? Because there are lots of therapists out there who aren't necessarily that spiritual. Though these days it's getting more rare.
Well, when I graduated from college, I went to Esalen Institute in residential program.
Okay.
And it was the third residential program they tried to run. It was the only one that actually went the full 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And so that was, I considered that graduate school. I mean, trust me, nobody else did.
Yeah.
But this was 1968. This was a really long time ago. And that residential program focused on meditation and body work.
Oh, interesting.
So that, for me, has always been a foundation.
Okay.
Then I had to go to graduate school after that.
Right.
And the theory, I mean, Esalen was experimenting with how to run a residential program. There were 11 handpicked people And we spent 40 or 50 hours a week together, and we worked with the top people at that time.
Oh, wow.
And
any names that people would recognize today?
I don't even want to go into
okay. it. Okay. All right.
Was,
no worries.
It was everybody who was anybody in 1968.
Hmm.
And so that for me was the foundation. But after that, and I stayed at Esalen, of course, for a couple of years working.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, I had to go to graduate school.
Right.
And so with that foundation, I switched to research in graduate school because it seemed a safer bet. The graduate schools had not caught up to the level of psychotherapy that Esalen was experimenting with.
I bet.
And
I bet.
So I was better off on a research track. And that's how I spent a decade in a research office and did all that work.
Okay. And so I guess you started meditating at that time.
And before.
Even before that. Wow.
I'd been searching. I'd had experiences as a child and growing up. And so I'd already been on a path. That's how I ended up at Esalen at age 21.
Okay.
I had really been searching.
So your roots go like really into childhood.
Yeah.
And anything you'd care to share or not? We can move on.
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's Charlie Tart, you know, the psychologist who's done a lot of parapsychological work.
Uh-huh.
He has a website where he's been asking scientists for their childhood peak experiences.
Oh.
And many, many scientists have peak. I mean, many people have peak experiences,
sure.
And especially from childhood.
Okay.
But I sort of pursued those experiences. I found them very meaningful and wanted to know more about them.
Oh, okay, great, great. Okay, so let's move on, and we'll just start to touch upon our main topic today, which is your book, Listening to Ayahuasca. How did you come to decide to focus on this particular plant medicine, as it's known, and why did you decide to do all this research around it?
Yeah, I can't claim any of those decisions, so I can explain how it evolved.
Okay.
But you'll see pretty soon I was not exactly in charge of anything.
Okay.
And so what happened is, once my daughter was finished her graduate school and I was feeling quite free,
mm-hmm.
I was living in Princeton, New Jersey, and I was searching, this is not part of a spiritual search, I was looking for a beach vacation. It was February. I thought, well, this makes perfect sense.
Funny how those things work.
Yeah. So I had set up a vacation at a retreat center that I thought sounded very exotic in Costa Rica between the rainforest and the Pacific Ocean. And 2 days before I was scheduled to leave, I got a phone call from the person who was arranging it.
Uh-huh.
And she said, well, do you want to participate in the ceremonies? And I brilliantly said, what ceremonies? I missed all the keywords in the descriptions. I didn't get
them. Wait a minute. So you booked this vacation.
I booked it. I had no idea.
2 days before, you're going down to Costa Rica. And then they call you up and say, oh, are you participating in the ceremonies?
Right.
And this was right over your head.
No clue what they're talking about. So I immediately, you know, I said, let me call you back. And I had Ralph Metzner's book on ayahuasca.
Ah, okay.
The first edition of it. So this is way back. And, you know, I read through all the personal reports, all the first-person reports, and I was just ready.
Mm-hmm.
I had had psychedelic experiences in the 60s.
Okay.
And then I was a householder raising a daughter, and now I was fairly free. I was ready.
Yeah, interesting. So it's kind of funny how, like, you didn't even realize what you were putting yourself in the middle of.
No, so I did no screening whatsoever, which is not, you know, I really say to audiences, don't do as I do, do as I say. I didn't know.
Right. Okay, great. All right, so wonderful. We're laying the foundation. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, let's talk about then, like, what happened in Costa Rica and, you know, how this whole thing evolved.
Great.
All right? So everybody, please stay tuned. You're listening to The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. My guest this hour is Dr. Rachel Harris, author of the book Listening to Ayahuasca, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Hello, I'm JC.
I'm Joan.
And welcome to 21st Century Entrepreneur. We bring education,
insight,
knowledge,
awareness,
trouble,
craziness, and fun
for you, the entrepreneur who's looking to build your business
and your community. Listen every Friday from noon to 1 Eastern on talkradio.nyc. And you can tweet us at 21st CE Radio or Talk Alternative.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking this hour to Dr. Rachel Harris, author of the book Listening to Ayahuasca. So when we left off, you're leaving for Costa Rica. We haven't even gotten down to Costa Rica yet. And you find out, oh, there's going to be some ceremonial work done in Costa Rica using ayahuasca. Was it only ayahuasca? Did they use any other plant medicines down there?
We did drink some preparatory purging.
Oh, some like tobacco elixir?
No, it was not tobacco elixir. I have no idea what it was. I mean, this is often the case. We don't know what we're given.
Yeah.
They were shamans from Ecuador.
Oh, from Ecuador.
And we did flower baths, or flower showers, really. Mm-hmm. And we did drink something before, but I don't really know even what it was. And who knows what's in an ayahuasca mix? You're handed
muddy tea.
Something, and you know, down it goes. So
what was your, I mean, just briefly, I don't want to look on it, but I'm curious, like your first experience with ayahuasca, what was that like?
Well, ayahuasca took me back to my father's death.
Oh.
So you can just imagine how meaningful this was.
Yeah.
And I had had an experience of what's called a shared death experience, where at the time of his actual dying, I went part way with him.
Oh.
And I got scared.
Uh-huh,
and
bet.
I brought myself back into my body, into the room.
Uh-huh.
And so I asked to go back to that and make a conscious decision, since you're the conscious consultant, to make a conscious decision to go through with the whole experience. And so that's what, I really feel that's what ayahuasca gave me, that first ceremony. And so that was really important for me, both at a psychological level in terms of my relationship with my father and another chance to have a final goodbye, and then spiritually, because I emerged into the grand cosmos, into the universe. So there were both levels happening. And the very next morning, I was full of questions. Mm. And even with a translator there, these are Western psychotherapy questions. Shaman from Ecuador couldn't care less about these stupid questions from a woman, no less. So I knew, you know, I was on my own with these and that I wanted to continue.
Oh,
I mean, when I arrived back in the States, I called everyone, right?
Right.
And I said, I found the fountain of youth. I mean, what better advertisement for people my age? And so I was... that really inspired me. And after a couple of other opportunities, I actually heard a voice, a real auditory voice. I mean, as clear as I hear your voice in this room.
Uh-huh.
And the voice said, do the research.
Oh.
And that's what started this whole thing.
And was this voice a male voice or a female voice?
Oh, no, it's clearly a female voice. I mean, this is a voice that people call Grandmother Ayahuasca.
Yeah.
The question is, you know, what really is this voice?
And right.
You know, people say, well, it's one of your inner voices, it's something you're projecting. And, you know, I heard a voice has driven me slightly crazy for about a decade. But, you know, I asked, one of the ways I handled this was I asked two quite famous religion professors who I'm close with. And it was Bob Foreman on the East Coast, and he's an expert on mysticism.
Right.
And I asked him, and his answer was very clear, we don't know. Then on the West Coast, I was having breakfast with Houston Smith and another religion professor, and I asked him, and the answer was exactly the same. We don't know. And I know they did not coordinate. This was a year later. But that, because they're such experts, their response kind of gave me permission to admit, I don't know, and to hang right. out in that mystery.
Right. Right. Now, you had a background in doing research, but this kind of research that you ended up going on, it's kind of different than sort of traditional.
Oh, I had no controls. I mean, it was underground right. research. I had no way to control anything.
Now, you made a very specific choice to study people who've experienced the medicine here in the United States or in right. North America.
Right.
Why that?
Well, here's my professional answer. My professional okay. answer is I was interested in how Westerners were using this medicine.
Okay.
And I wasn't focusing on the experiences.
Right.
There's actually good research about that and a lot of first person reports.
Right.
As a therapist, I was asking research questions. How do you change? What's different about you? How right. is your life right. different? But the real honest truth is I did not want to schlep around South America. I mean, I'm really not very, you know, sturdy or brave.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I was in Costa Rica, there was a poisonous snake that crossed over, nice. You know, this grassy area
the
that we were all walking across.
Yeah.
And they put the head of the snake on a stick and said, well, this will keep other poisonous snakes away. And that did not encourage me any. So I focused on North America. Now you have both right. sides
it's
of the answer.
A little safer. the professional and the realist.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you find it difficult finding at the time? I mean, this wasn't... when did you start the research?
The research was done around 2007 or 8 to 2011. Right. It was published in 2012.
Right. So it was... I mean... I've been aware of ayahuasca before even I started doing my own medicine work the last 3 years, about 3 or 4 years, about 7 years ago, so about 2010. So this was even a little bit before then, and this was
yeah.
before sort of the popularity that exists
it
today
was
around
quiet.
It.
It was
relatively
much
quiet.
Quieter.
So how did you find, and you created this whole like forum for people, this huge...
This is what researchers do yes,
right?
The answers,
you know,
yes.
This huge thing for me. How
but
did you
know,
find
but
people?
But you know how I created it? I interviewed Western shaman. Who
oh.
were trained by indigenous shaman. I got
okay.
the highest level people I could get.
Okay.
And I basically said, what should I ask them? And one of the women shaman, very sensitive,
mm-hmm.
said, make sure you ask about their relationship with the spirit of ayahuasca. And that was, I would never have asked that myself. I didn't know enough to ask it.
Right.
And that one research question was really a revelation.
Okay. And this research, I mean, really, you started doing this research because you heard grandmother tell you
she said do the research. I didn't even question it.
Right.
I just thought, you know, this is my, I mean, I have to laugh at myself. Yeah. This is my own ego inflation, which is something we all have to be careful of.
Right.
But I thought, oh, I'm a great choice for this.
Yeah.
You know, I have the research background. I know how to do it. I involved an old research mentor who's extremely prestigious.
Oh, okay.
And he was great help.
Okay.
And we really did it together. And I had the therapeutic experience to
right.
know what kind of therapy questions to ask. But people wanted to talk about
mm-hmm.
what happened to them afterwards.
Oh, really?
The research questionnaire was 16 pages long.
Wow, 16 pages.
And included an enormous number of essay questions.
Ah.
It took hours to complete. And people, even after completing the 16 pages, they would write me personal letters.
Oh,
people
really?
Wanted to share,
wow.
and they wanted to support research into this medicine that had been so helpful to them.
Wow, wow. So you found that there was a real passion among the people
yes, that's exactly
who actually
right.
experienced it, and they wanted this kind of information to come out.
Yes, now that raises the question, and people have asked this, maybe you only found people who were... And this is a problem with this kind of rolling admissions into a research project.
Right.
Project. Maybe you only found people who had good experiences.
Right.
So it's skewed positive. So somewhere in there, I began looking, actively looking and asking, you know, my networks. I had good
right.
networks all around.
Okay.
Asking my networks for bad experiences. And
okay.
and I interviewed a lot of the people with bad experiences.
Right.
And we would go through really difficult, challenging, miserable stories.
Right.
And then they would say, but I learned so much. It was so helpful for me. I would do it again.
Yeah.
Now, that's not exactly a bad trip that's damaging. Or,
right.
You know, there
right.
are stories of bad trips where people are anxious for months afterwards.
Yeah,
or
yeah,
those.
Yeah, yeah.
I had very few of those.
Right, right. But even those that you had, I believe you said in your research, people still gain something from it. So,
and I go into my bad trip. I think the section is called My Good Bad Trip or something like that, because it was so helpful. And, and this level of bad trip is by definition, you know, spending 5 hours with our neurosis,
right,
you know, just
right.
mired in our neurotic patterns. You know, you can get a lot of
So there's value. So even though it was unpleasant, let's not call it, it's not necessarily a bad trip. It was unpleasant. It was uncomfortable.
Yes.
But there was still therapeutic value.
Yes, there was great therapeutic
In some
value.
Ways, more therapeutic value than when the it's not
hard,
the unpleasant.
It's hard. You know, I can't prioritize.
Yes, they were.
Yeah, and people generally found these really challenging experiences to be therapeutic.
Yeah, I mean, I personally know people who have done, you know, various ceremonial work, and the what I've observed of them just myself is that usually the most growth happened after a very unpleasant ceremony.
Yes, the time after the ceremony, I call it the golden days and weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The time after the ceremony is such a therapeutic opportunity.
Yeah.
And especially with a difficult, challenging experience of your own personal neuroses. I mean, those days afterward are so valuable.
Yeah,
and I'm not really just talking about integration. A lot of people are talking about integration where you rest and do yoga and continue the diet and maybe journal and those kinds of things. I'm a therapist. I'm talking about therapy.
Right. So you really, your research has a very particular slant, shall we say, towards what, if any, was the therapeutic value that people got out of it.
Exactly.
So did you find that there was a lot of therapeutic value?
Yeah, there was kind of a pattern, and other research studies are beginning to replicate it.
Okay.
And the pattern of after effects, basically, or benefits, is people felt their sense of themselves improved.
Mm-hmm.
They were more accepting, more self-compassionate.
Mm-hmm.
Their relationships with their family members, their important relationships, they were more invested in them. They valued them more.
Right.
They wanted more. The word that often came up was, I want more authentic relationships. People also reported weeding out toxic relationships. Interesting. So they felt better about themselves. They suffered with less depression and anxiety.
Okay.
And so you can see how they'd become more available.
Right.
Their health behaviors spontaneously improved. This is not something psychologists are very good at changing. So this was sort of shocking. People ate better. They exercised more. Many people, I mean, a number who I interviewed and followed up for 5 to 7 years looked like they were becoming alcoholics. They stopped. I mean, they would wake up the next morning and say, alcohol is toxic, I'm not touching it.
Really?
Yeah, and they would stop, and I followed them, and they stopped.
Right.
And then there was a huge philosophical shift where they felt their relationship to nature, to the universe, took, I mean, it was a real sense of spiritual relationship that shifted.
So it not only kind of opened people up to sort of the less physical side of life, shall we call it, an energetic side of life.
Right.
But they opened up to being more self-care, more self-compassion, to being truer to themselves and wanting to be more authentic to themselves and with other people.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a goal that therapists have and can spend years with.
These are all
clients.
Therapeutic goals, absolutely.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, so we're going to dive a little bit deeper into some of the findings that Dr. Harris found right after this break. So everybody, please stay with us. You're listening to The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
If you have an interest in marijuana, you want to know about marijuana, law, policy, and culture, then feel free to join me, Joseph A. Bondi, every Friday at 11 o'clock in the morning on my show, In the Know 420 on TalkingAlternative.com. Legalize the earth to continue to resist the past.
consideration of this necessary legislation.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of The Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on The Rob and Callie Show Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.myc.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We're talking this hour with Dr. Rachel Harris, author of the book Listening to Ayahuasca, now available. Before we go on into some of the more findings, while you were doing this research, did you find among your peer community that there was a lot of resistance? Did people scoff at this and say, oh, there's just a bunch of people doing drugs or whatever? Or did you find like people, like your colleagues were like, that could be an interesting area?
I was rather quiet about the whole thing.
Okay, so not too many people.
But I can tell you, my co-author for the study, as I said, is a nationally recognized psychologist.
Right.
And he was incredibly open. I mean, when we got at one point, not under the influence, not in a ceremony, not even around a ceremony, I again heard the voice, and the voice gave me in one sentence a new way to look at the data analysis. So I called my prestigious co-author and I said, Grandmother Ayahuasca says we should interpret the findings this way.
Yeah.
There was silence on the other end of the phone. He said, okay, let me look at that. And so when we finally completed the study, you know, I said to him, you know, there should be a third author here, but we did not include her. But there was this, and with the book too, I felt there were coincidences that happened. I felt I had help all along the way.
Oh, really?
And the book goes into a much broader look at what it means to work with this medicine and what it means personally and therapeutically. And I have a lot of quotes from people and what happens afterwards. And and the really amazing finding from the study that then persists in all the interviews I've done is that 75% of the people reported an ongoing relationship with the spirit of ayahuasca.
Oh, really? So 75%? Wow.
Now, they didn't all hear an auditory communication. Right. But they felt they could communicate with her in meditation and dreams. They had different, or in just intuitively. So there was this sense of having a therapeutic presence. And this is part of what makes this particular medicine unique, is this quality of a personal relationship with the plant teacher that's part of the whole experience.
Right, right. So what were some of the findings in going through? I mean, how many, well, first of all, how many respondents or how many people did you interview? Or?
Well, 81 people completed the research questionnaire. And then I've interviewed another 50.
Oh,
and,
wow, okay.
You know, a dozen or so I followed up for many, many years.
Okay.
And these were, ostensibly research interviews, but they morphed into psychotherapy very quickly. And I can give you an example of that. There was one young woman who came and talked about her experience of the divine feminine and archetype and how this was wonderful for her and gave her a vision of becoming a woman. She was in her mid late 20s. And I, you know, she went on for a good 10, 15 minutes about this. And then I couldn't control myself any longer. And I said, and tell me about your relationship with your mother.
Yeah.
And she burst into tears. So there are always levels of work being done.
Right.
And if we only do the archetypal level, then we're missing the psychological opportunity.
Right, right.
And she had real work to do with her. I mean, you know, if you ask someone about their mother, we don't all burst into tears immediately.
Right.
So there was work to be done.
Right.
And
right.
I never want to skip that basic family of origin work.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because those are the foundational relationships
that
shape us.
It's the foundation. Right.
Did you find that the respondents that had people usually, did they just go to one ceremony? Did they been to several ceremonies?
The criteria was that they had been at least to one ceremony in North America. So some people were members of one of the syncretic churches.
Oh, yeah.
And so they reported they'd been to 200 ceremonies.
Wow.
But, you know, the churches meet every 2 weeks. And these are, these churches have, they're from Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one in New Mexico and two connected in Oregon, and they have the legal right to use this indigenous tea as a sacrament. So it's purely as part of the religious ceremony. It's a sacrament.
Right, right. And was that common with the people that experienced the ceremony? The ceremony was always a very sacred space for people?
I was surprised that pretty much everybody was in a ritualized setting.
Right.
Now, you know, this is now, the data was collected 7 years ago.
Yeah.
We don't know how it's changing.
Yeah.
And this medicine is meant to be used in a ritual setting with a shaman present.
Right.
And the kind of energetic healing that goes on, the shaman sort of orchestrates.
Right. Now,
And I want to add, and provide safety for the participants. That's really important.
And I actually wanted to ask about that. Did you find any issues with the shaman that people worked with? Was there any
you're talking about rape. Let's just be really clear about it. Yeah.
But not because just rape, but there can be other manipulations too.
Right. Because most of the people were responding about their North American experience. I didn't, but I did interview a few people who'd had bad experience in South America. One woman in particular has been talking and lecturing and writing about really being targeted by a shaman. He mixed in Datura into the ayahuasca, and she was not quite totally conscious for a few weeks, and it was part of his being. It was he used Datura like a rape drug, and she was at his mercy.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be very blunt about this and say, yes, there are real issues of manipulations around the usual story of sex and money.
Right. I mean, wherever there's power, there's opportunity for
corruption. These are old stories mixed in with spiritual experiences.
How did you find most people found the ceremonies? Because it is an underground thing.
You know, I didn't ask that.
Oh, you never asked.
I mean,
there
are a couple of things I didn't ask. I didn't ask if people stopped. You know, what if they stopped smoking cigarettes? And I'm sorry, I didn't ask that because there's findings at Hopkins that people who have a complete mystical experience with psilocybin are able to quit
cigarettes,
which is really hard to do.
Yeah. And I know they're doing a lot of research now at NYU with psilocybin therapeutic benefits.
Right.
As you were compiling the research and looking at stuff, were there any surprises along the way, things that you didn't expect?
Well, the biggest surprise was the ongoing relationship with Grandmother Ayahuasca.
Okay.
That was really the biggest surprise. And the book only really talks about the research in the first couple of chapters. Most of the book is a real exploration of how ayahuasca is being used. And and I had to do a chapter on mediumship. Because it wasn't a surprise, but it was difficult for me to write about it in a way that made sense to me. But many people are reporting working with spirits. And of course, even asking the question, are they real, is not quite the right question.
Right.
It's really saying, what's happening here? How is this working? And is it therapeutic for you? Part of the assumption is that it's therapeutic for the spirit. I didn't know how to do research in that area. But I explore that.
I know people who can do research in that area.
Oh, good. Because somebody should
lots of people
be.
Are. Right.
Yeah. And then there's a chapter on what's happening in the brain that allows for the therapeutic changes that happen. And some of the findings are the architecture of our brain, I mean, the way the neurons are connected and how we structure our personality, that all softens. and begins to change. And there are new connections, new neurological, I mean, it's literal, neurological connections can be made. And so that opens up the opportunity to make conscious choices. I mean, we're all wired from early childhood.
Right.
But
right.
as an adult, we can look at our experiences differently and make different decisions about how we want to be in our lives.
Right, right. Our past doesn't necessarily have to shape our future, even though it may influence it.
Doesn't have to.
Right. Were there any, like, really remarkable breakthroughs that you learned about that?
Well, you know, these are inexplicable. I mean, some people did report a lifelong depression has lifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another person reported she'd been on antidepressants for 20 years, the age of 18 to 38.
Wow.
And had done numerous ceremonies, but she started microdosing. This is sort of a hot topic these days.
Yes.
So she would take just a few eyedropper drops under her tongue of ayahuasca in the morning. So she had no effect from no psychedelic effects whatsoever.
Right.
She lived her normal life. She did this maybe twice a week and
no more antidepressants.
No more antidepressants.
Oh, wow.
And this is, she has a diagnosis of major depression.
Wow.
This is not a light, right. you know, I need a little help. This was right. lifelong depression.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you find that everybody had a strong experience when they went into ceremony?
You know, after my good experience in Costa Rica, I organized a group of my nearest and dearest friends to return.
Uh-huh.
And they were all experienced in many different spiritual disciplines.
Okay.
And one couple sat through two ceremonies, bored to tears, nothing at all happened. And they drank twice as much as I drank.
Wow.
And nothing happened. Absolutely nothing. And I saw this about a year ago in a circle where an experienced woman, again, took an extra cup. You know, you can ask for a second cup.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely nothing happened. It's a long night to sit there, you know, with nothing going on.
Yeah.
It's the first time that ever happened to her. And then she reported driving home. All of a sudden, she burst into tears and had sort of a therapeutic conversation with a sibling she'd been having trouble with.
Oh.
She had to pull off the road, cried, talked to the sibling in her, you know, in the car in her imagination.
Right, in her imagination.
And it changed her relationship with that sibling.
Oh.
So even though nothing happened in ceremony, look at what happened after. It was so valuable for her.
Right.
And how do we explain this?
Right.
We have no way.
So we just don't want to be clear that, you know, it's... Not everybody has these mind-blowing, amazing experiences, but that doesn't mean that there's not some therapeutic benefit that happens after the ceremony.
Right, but, you know, I also want to talk about the downside. I was just at the MAPS conference, and one of the researchers from, I think, Brazil reported on, I think he had 5 cases of psychotic breaks as a result of an ayahuasca experience. And, you know, I remember talking with a Western shaman who'd been in a mentorship for a few decades.
Mm.
And she reported at the retreat center in Peru, someone had a psychotic break. And I excitedly asked, well, how did the shaman treat it? She said, oh, we shipped him out. We sent him back to the city to a hospital. So there's no, you know, no magic for everything.
Right.
And I, you know, that I had, that was a naive question on my part and assumption.
Right.
So we have to be realistic. There are risks.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And going back to how you mentioned before about the idea of screening, that it is important to maybe ask some questions.
Oh, absolutely.
Before a ceremony to see.
Right. Make sure the reputation is sterling.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Believe it or not, I think this is our last break of the show. Everything goes by so fast. We have such interesting guests. So everybody, please stay tuned. You're listening to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on TalkingAlternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to secretsofthesire.com.
TalkingAlternative.com.
Welcome back to the Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity. We've been speaking this hour to Dr. Rachel Harris, author of the book, Listening to Ayahuasca. So I wanted to ask you, because the subtitle for your book is New Hope for Depression, Addiction, PTSD, and Anxiety. Why did you put all that in there?
Well, that sort of covers the waterfront, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, that's pretty much like, I know it's everything like our therapist deals with here in our center.
Right. Those are the most common things. Because that's what people are suffering with. And, mm-hmm. you know, even as miraculous as the SSRIs, the antidepressants have mm-hmm. been in the last couple of decades, there's still 30 to 50% who are not helped by them.
Right, and right. They're very toxic for the body, most SSRIs.
People don't really like the side effects. Yeah. They're real side effects.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's even, you know, I almost started to say the side effects of ayahuasca. Of course, there's purging during the ceremony. Right. But that's not really a side effect. There's no lasting
right.
side effect. People generally feel better
absolutely.
Couple of days after.
Yeah, and as you mentioned before, then they take better care of themselves. And
it's actually a much safer. If we had ways to control and regulate the ceremonies, that would be a safer
right.
medicine.
Right, right.
Yeah, and I can say something about PTSD.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
people
please.
Often report reliving childhood traumas or pieces right. of childhood history. And they report it in two ways. Sometimes they're actually reliving it. So they're 3 right. years old, they're in the middle of it. And that can be quite traumatic.
Right.
And, you know, we don't want people to get caught in that reliving again and again. And I have
right.
heard of cases of that.
Yeah.
And when that happens, that's almost re-traumatizing. And that person really needs intervention
right.
to get more distance. Other people report like watching a film of an experience they had in their childhood at
right.
maybe 3 years old too. But they know they're an adult
right.
watching this movie of their childhood. So that's already a therapeutic distance there
right.
and enables them to have their adult presence about what happened to them and begin to see it differently.
Right.
So
now your focus, we mentioned a little before about integration, but I mean, your focus was really kind of not what happened in the ceremony as much as what happened after the ceremony for
really
people.
And I'm really interested in the weeks and months afterwards and what
right.
happens when someone is working with this medicine and
right.
is also in a therapeutic relationship.
Right.
So they're in therapy, say, weekly.
Mm-hmm.
They're in, maybe they go to a ceremony once every couple of months, whatever their preference is.
Right.
But there's this sense of back and forth between the two experiences.
Right.
But this assumes that the therapist has this kind of experience where they know how to work on these different levels and differentiate
mm-hmm. yeah.
a psychological issue from a spiritual experience.
Yeah, I consider myself extremely fortunate because my wife does EMDR and had been, she actually, you know, had talked about seeing her own EMDR therapist.
Yes.
But it wasn't until we started doing ceremonial work that she actually made the effort and talked to her supervisor and started working with her. And she would tell me about all these experiences. And sometimes the EMDR session, she said, was almost like a spiritual experience. So then eventually I actually started seeing the same therapist because she's very well known in the New York community in EMDR. Mm-hmm. And it like moved so quickly through it, and it really helped to integrate because EMDR is also not just a talk based
right.
therapy.
It's very body oriented.
It's very body oriented, and
yes.
I found that it really sort of exponentiated the process
yes.
of the integration and what's happening. So it is. I mean, I guess this would be something you would agree with to recommend that, like, if you're doing ceremonial work, if you can also be seeing a therapist at the same time, like, that's the best of both worlds.
I think that's the best of both worlds. As long as you have a therapist who can travel in all that inner right. landscape and territory and right. differentiate between levels.
Right, right.
Yes, I think that's the best.
Right, and it was interesting because even though the therapist we used didn't have any experience with ceremonial work, she had a very spiritual practice
yes.
and a very spiritual underpinning to herself, so she could
right.
work
she's,
through the
she's
stuff.
She's traveled in her own inner territory,
exactly.
so she can recognize.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, about the research, I mean, what do you think are like sort of some of the key things? I mean, not everyone should go out and buy the book, of course, but what are some of the key things that your research revealed that you think is important for people to understand about what can happen after a ceremony?
Right. You know, my research and all the research that's going on about psychedelics, psilocybin mostly,
mm-hmm.
Really opens up the opportunity. The word that's used most often is recalibrate, reset,
okay.
reorganize.
Right.
There's an opportunity to make different choices about how the person wants to structure themselves in their own life.
Right.
So there's a real chance to make basic changes that really change the trajectory of a
right.
life.
Right. And changes that normally take, if ever, you know,
in therapy alone.
Therapy alone, right. you know, decades to,
and,
to make.
And I think one of the central ones is, do I feel loved? And some of the quotes after an ayahuasca experience is, you know, I can say I feel loved. I can say I love myself.
Right.
But in the ceremony, I experienced being loved at a cosmic mm-hmm. level that yeah. soaked all the way into my bones and my yeah. DNA. And that's a spiritual experience of feeling loved.
Right.
And that begins to change everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, you did, although you didn't have a control group per se, you did have a group that you compared some of the stuff to, right?
In the initial research. And I don't
yeah.
really talk about that very much in the book, but I did have a comparison group. We don't really know how to do research with ayahuasca
yeah.
yet. We don't know how to control for the medicine. I think MAPS had
right.
a project they were developing where they were going to work with shaman, and they were going to use the capsules, the dry, freeze-dried ayahuasca that's being used in Barcelona, where they can control the potency and the dosage.
Oh, really? I didn't know it's being used in Barcelona.
And, yeah, they're doing a lot of research in Barcelona. So they had this all set up with the freeze-dried capsules. The shaman refused to work with it. They said the spirit is missing.
Missing, yeah.
So this is where we are with the beginning of the research, so
yeah.
you can see how far we have to go.
Right, right, right. So the book came out a couple of months ago.
Just about six weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Initial reactions? How have people been responding to it?
I've been very pleased with how people are responding to the book. I kind of put my heart and soul into the book. Everything that came out of a lifetime of work, whether it was my own spiritual work or research or psychotherapy mm-hmm. experience. It's really, the book itself is an integration of my career for me. And so you asked me offline, you know, what's next? And I really don't know what's next. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be called again or what would be called for. I don't know. But I kind of rose to do the job I was given.
Right. Do you have any intention behind this book? I mean, what do you hope would
happen?
Yes,
I have a
book?
Very clear intention. I hope it's helpful for people. And I hope it's helpful for therapists working with people who are working with the medicine. And that it's useful for people considering, should I try this
mm-hmm.
medicine, or for people afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope it encourages people to consider going to a therapist afterwards to really work with it. With all the potential possibilities.
Right, right. Now, this research you had done, I mean, a couple of years ago, it's been taking a little while to collate and analyze and put everything together. Do you see anything over the last couple of years shifting and changing in the landscape, in the medicine landscape?
Well, you know, it's an underground medicine landscape.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the question is, who do you trust to go to a ceremony?
Mm. Right.
And is it someone who's had 6 months experience or a few
years
or not even 6 years? I mean, it really should be decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And in our culture, we kind of don't have a very good understanding of that,
right.
that it takes decades to really learn how to work with the medicine and the Icaros, which are the songs that people sing.
Yes.
You know, so I'm very serious about that. And then on the other hand, somebody said to me, oh, yes, I've been to 5 or 6 ceremonies, and there's a DJ. They play recorded music. And I sort of want to tear my hair out. But then he talks about how he's benefited.
Yeah.
And he's really experienced important therapeutic benefits. So I was glad I kept my mouth shut. But in general, I would tend to say, I hope the ceremonies retain their holistic ritual, where it's the medicine and the Ikaros, the music, and that it's a complete ritual.
Right, right. And it retains its sort of spiritual quality to it, because it is a spiritual ritual.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm just curious, and not whether it's in the book or not, but just personally, have you learned more about sort of the indigenous culture behind these ceremonies for yourself personally?
Well, the indigenous culture can also be very dark.
Yeah.
And, some people who maybe are partially trained as shaman become infatuated with power and control, and they go off to the dark side. And there are terrible stories from indigenous shaman about attacks between shamans. Yeah. So there's a dark side to this medicine.
You know what I just picked up again recently? I had read these books when I was in high school, and it's like I can barely remember anything, so I said, you know what, this is important, I need to read them again. I just picked up the Teachings of Don Juan,
the Castaneda
books.
Yeah.
and I'm like reading it now, and it's, of course, I'm getting a very different message, and it's very interesting to revisit that body of work.
Right, and the power can go either way, and of course that's true for all of us.
Right. Yeah, and I just want to end on a point that for the one thing that I've learned is that there's also a real difference between the Mestizo tradition in South America and tribal, and that, sort of after the conquistadors came in, the Indians did adapt somewhat of a patriarchal model from the Christianity, but really the true indigenous culture is much more tribal and less kind of hierarchical in a way. And there is a difference, and I've experienced there's a difference in those approaches towards ceremony.
I honestly don't, I can't really speak to that. I don't really know for sure.
Yeah. One of my little things I've learned. Anyway,
okay, good.
I really appreciate you taking the time to come into studio today,
so
Dr.
Much,
Harris. Though. It was wonderful having you here. Let me hold it up for the Facebook live stream one more time. Listening to Ayahuasca by Dr. Rachel Harris. Go out and get the book. It's a wonderful book. Anybody involved with ceremonial work, thinking about getting involved with ceremonial work, this is an invaluable resource towards it. So thank you, Dr. Harris, and
thank you so much.
I hope all the best for you. And so for all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in today. I really want to encourage people, if you have not yet signed up for our newsletter, please go to the website, if you've not already, talkradio.nyc, and sign up for our newsletter so that you can be aware of the different shows and different topics coming up, so you can see the amazing offerings that we have. I highly encourage that. Well, it's the end of another show. Thank you all for tuning in and listening. Thank you all for the Facebook live stream listeners. Of course, it'll be available afterwards. And we will have more shows available for you. And we will talk to you next week.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Hello, I'm JC.
I'm Joan.
And welcome to 21st Century Entrepreneur. We bring education,
insight,
knowledge,
awareness,
trouble,
craziness, and fun.
For you, the entrepreneur who's looking to build your business
and your community. Listen every Friday from noon to 1 Eastern on talkradio.nyc. And you can tweet us at 21st CE Radio or Talk Alternative.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on TalkingAlternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to SecretsOfTheSire.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Hi, this is Rob Kay.
And I'm Callie Alpert.
And we're hosts of The Rob and Callie Show. Are you looking for a show that talks about real stuff like life, love, the pursuit of being yourself?
Then you have come to the right place because we cover topics ranging from chivalry to gratitude to your relationship with money and everything in between.
So listen to us on The Rob and Callie Show, Tuesdays, 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on talkradio.myc.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.